Good morning, everybody, and welcome. I'm here to convene this session, which is called Coordinated Autonomy, Central ERP in the Decentralized Institution. I have a few jobs here. One is to welcome our online community, so thanks out there for watching. Another task of mine is my great pleasure to introduce our speakers. On the farther right, we have Jeff Korb. I apologize for reading, but Jeff is Senior Director of Enterprise Applications at the Johns Hopkins University, responsible for the university's central administrative systems, including SAP implementation, which is shared between the university and the Hopkins Health System, and the Student Information System, in addition to the university's portfolio of centrally managed educational technology solutions. To his left, we have Jason Schaffner. Jason is Director of Financial Systems Solutions at Harvard University, responsible for providing project management, business analysis, application configuration, and other consulting services in support of Oracle eBusiness Suite, PeopleSoft Enterprise, Hyperion Planning, a customs grant management application suite, and numerous other systems supporting the university's financial administration operations. I am also to announce that online session evaluations will be available until November 2nd, so I encourage everybody to fill those out. And then I also have two interaction options. One is minimal. If everybody could take out your phone and put it on silent or vibrate, that would be great. Another interaction is optimal, which is you could turn off your device altogether and give your undivided attention to Jeff and Jason.
Thank you. And right on the heels of that, we're going to encourage the Twitter handle for the hashtag for the session. So we have a special tag for this session. Also, there's the Edu11 tag for general tweeting. Jeff and I are pretty active tweeps, so we'll be checking in later to see what everybody thought. So first I want to talk a little bit about some of the objectives of this presentation. What we were thinking about doing here really first is talking about our organizational context. So what does the structure look like? What is our enterprise systems landscape? What are some of the challenges and constraints that each of us faces in our organizations? And then using a couple of recent projects to illustrate some of the obstacles and solutions that we have undertaken to deal with the high degree of decentralization in our institutions. And then do some comparisons and contrasts between both of our organizations and lessons that we've learned. So when Jeff and I were talking about putting together a proposal for a presentation, we've worked together over the years. I did some work at Johns Hopkins on their student implementation that Jeff will talk about. We're really talking about, well, what theme could we get together on to present here? And we really started talking about the degree of decentralization that each of us deals with. And on this spectrum, this simple graphic of the spectrum of decentralized to centralized, we really feel that we're pretty far beyond on the left side in terms of the degree of decentralization that our organizations represent. A little bit about myself. As Ted mentioned, I'm the Director of Financial Systems Solutions at Harvard. And in that capacity, I'm responsible for application strategy, business analysis, and project management for the financial enterprise administrative applications. I've been working in higher ed for a long time, focusing on ERP, budgeting and planning, and also student information systems. And I'm also an alum of the college, so I have a little bit of extra interest in the success of the projects.
And in terms of my name is Jeff Korb from Johns Hopkins. I'm the Senior Director of Enterprise Applications, as Ted told you, principally responsible for the business systems. Our IT organization at Johns Hopkins spans both our university and our health system, which are actually two separate corporate entities, which creates lots of challenges, and I'll share some of that as we go through the presentation today. But our ERP is shared between those two areas, so that's how my responsibilities get split. Also, the student systems and academic technology arena for Fort Hopkins. As similar to Jason, we met working on an implementation at Hopkins of our student system that I'll talk a little bit more about during the presentation. And also, we share another common thread in that I'm an alum of Hopkins myself, so we have another vested interest in our success. So we wanted to talk a little bit about our title, Coordinated Autonomy. I thought I lifted this from a presentation I think Cornell did about 3 or 4 years ago at EDUCAUSE in Seattle. And then learned that they, in fact, lifted it from a colleague at UCLA, Jim Davis, from an article written in EDUCAUSE Review in 2001. And he used the term to describe kind of the pressures between the individual and the institution. We embraced that definition, but we kind of expanded it a little in terms of the context for our conversation here to think about the pressures between entities within an institution. So in our case, Hopkins has 9 schools, and each school works very autonomously. And our job in central IT is really to coordinate what those schools do in centralized systems that we manage. So we thought that the title was fitting. We just had to adjust the definition just a little to for our points.
So I'm going to spend a couple of minutes talking about the Harvard organizational context in terms of decentralization. At a glance, Harvard comprises 12 primary academic units, more than 20,000 degree candidates, approximately 25,000 instructional faculty. Are in terms of financial scale, fiscal 10 operating revenue and expenses were $3.7 billion. Our endowment at the end of fiscal 10 was valued at $27.5 billion. And you know, recent press releases, that's grown about 20% last fiscal year. We have a large physical plant, 600 buildings spread across Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Boston. And that's about 5,000 acres, 26 million gross square feet. One of the largest employers in Massachusetts, about 18,000 employees, 15,000 of which are full-time. And decentralization is really the key organizational model. I know this isn't at all readable, but it's really to give you an idea. This represents the academic organization with all of the schools and the deans of those schools reporting into the president and provost of the university. Within each of those schools, there may be nested organizational units that are also semi-autonomous. And when we use a word at Harvard called tub, which refers to this concept of every tub on its own bottom. And tubs really are responsible for their own financial integrity. And that includes ownership over endowment funds, the income of which is at their discretion to utilize on their organizational priorities, aligned with an overall institutional set of priorities. But this means that there's a high degree of autonomy within each one of the each one of the boxes on this org chart on the academic side in terms of how they choose to do business. And although there's a very large central administration, even the central administration is itself a very decentralized collection of entities. So to set some context, in my function, I report into the chief financial officer of the university. And I oversee, as I mentioned, the application strategy, implementation, project management. But I don't have any developers who report to me. They report into an organization that reports into the chief information officer. So even within the context of this large university and this large central administration, we have a microcosm of the decentralization that exists throughout the institution. Within this group, there are fee-for-service types of organizations that provide shared services functions to many schools, such as hospitality and dining, university operations, which deals with physical plant maintenance, electricity, chilled water, things of that nature across all of the schools. So the decentralization is really throughout every node in the organizational tree. This slide is kind of busy, but it comes from the annual report. It's 2 years old, but I like to use it to illustrate how different each of the schools are from each other. So we have one undergraduate institution, which is the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, which is where all of the undergraduate students are. The rest of the schools are professional schools and graduate schools. And this is a picture of where they derive the revenues and the degree to which they're dependent on endowment distributions. And just if you think about the varying degrees to which they're dependent on endowments, if you looked at the expense side, you'd also see very different pictures in terms of schools in the science area that have a high need for supplies and equipment for scientific research versus the Harvard Business School, which is more focused on professional services, food, and those types of expenses. So when we try to approach any kind of centralized ERP project, we're really thinking about treating it as a collection of very different implementations coordinated under one umbrella. In terms of the landscape for ERP at the university, we use several different tools. We approached our ERP selection over the years as a best-of-breed approach. Now most of the software up there is owned by Oracle, but wasn't when we made the selections. So we use Oracle Business Suite 11i for the financials applications implemented in 99, and we're in the process of upgrading to release 12 between now and next fall. We use PeopleSoft for the HCM functions, HR benefits, pension, payroll, time and labor, absence management, and we're also in the process of upgrading that to 9.1 over the next few months. We use Hyperion Planning for budgeting and analysis. We implemented that in 2009, 2010. And we use a custom grants management application that was implemented in 2004 to deal with the post, the pre and post award processing. And a underneath, or sort of overlaying all of it, is a data warehouse, a custom data warehouse used for analytics across all of the different ERP systems. You'll note that I don't mention student information. Student information is not a centralized ERP function. At this time, there are separate SIS installs at all of the different schools that comprise the institution. We have a centralized financial aspect in terms of billing, which falls under my area, but otherwise that is still a decentralized set of systems. And when I get to the case studies, I have picked a case, looked at some cases from our Hyperion Planning project as well as recent work we've been doing in Oracle eBusiness Suite. So when thinking about what the challenges are of managing ERP in this environment, there are a few things that come to mind. One is the differentiated requirements. So looking back to how different the needs are of the different schools, we have very legitimate differences in terms of what the operations are. Different embedded business units that have requirements that are more, that look more commercial than others. Different degrees of dependence on fund accounting, sponsored research, etc. And that makes it difficult for commercial off-the-shelf applications, as you might expect. Many of which could do any one of those things very nicely, but to allow all of the different configurations simultaneously is a big obstacle. We also are, since I've arrived, I've been at Harvard for 4 years, and we've been doing some work to try to unwind some rocky implementation history. It's not universally that way, but there are pockets of, well, remember when we made this decision in 1999, and there's a long institutional memory for those things. So as a result of that, there's also been a proliferation of shadow systems within some of the organizations to solve business needs that were unmet by the ERP systems. The every tub in its own bottom ethos, which is really a key consideration in terms of how we do projects and how governance works, is also resulted in the fact that with schools have funding and they have a legitimate need, there are a few obstacles to them solving that need. So this is another factor in the proliferation of shadow systems, and it also can be a disincentive to accepting enterprise-wide choices in putting in an application. And you're all probably familiar with the consensus decision-making process. So it's difficult for central administration to mandate conformance, even when we have a majority of the schools involved. And it's not just the schools. In some cases, we're talking about having to get 70 votes across schools and central units to try to reach accord on a strategic direction. So those are some of the challenges that we face with our enterprise environment.
I'll tell you a little bit about Johns Hopkins, and as an alum, as a current graduate student, and as a staff member, I would be remiss to not remind you that it is Johns, with an S, Hopkins. And the reason for that is he's named after his maternal great-grandmother. He endowed a university and a hospital. We'll talk a lot about hospital and medicine because it's very core to what Hopkins is. We were arguably the first research institution created in the country. We do have many undergraduate students, clearly lots of graduate students, but many undergraduate students who are actively engaged in research, and research is a very strong thread at Hopkins. We have about seven campuses, principally in the Baltimore area and around Maryland, Washington, D.C., and then global campuses in Italy and Nanjing, China. Our student distribution is about a third, a third, a third,
roughly speaking, undergraduates, divided between undergraduates and then full-time graduates and part-time graduates. We have 11 academic divisions, over 26,000 employees at the university. When you combine our university with our health system, we total over 50,000 employees, and Hopkins is then the largest private employer in the state of Maryland. As I mentioned, 21,000 students, about 2,600 full-time professorial faculty at the university. Our endowment is we're less than 10% of our colleague here. That's good and bad, I guess. I mean, they lost more, I think, in the financial downturn than we had. Not picking on them or anything. And we rank among the top universities in the country in terms of federal funding for research. About our culture and speaking to our decentralization, we're very decentralized. The every tub on its bottom applies as much to Hopkins as it does to Harvard. Our revenues are captured at the lowest levels of the organization within each of the schools, and the funds flow upward. The president himself has less than a half of a percent of university revenues at his disposal. The budgetary allocation function happens at the divisional level within each of the nine schools or the 11 academic divisions, not within the president's office, the provost's office, or the senior vice president's office. And similarly, that the distribution of both finance functions and HR functions happens into each of the schools and divisions of our university. The most we do centrally is kind of overseeing how things are happening within each of the schools and ensuring the schools are meeting their targets. But this allows us to have a high level of entrepreneurship and autonomy within the schools, which is celebrated by our faculty. It allows us to attract and retain people who like personal challenges at both the faculty level and at the staff level in terms of dealing with this administratively. And it gives us the ability to be very agile in new ventures, whatever they may be. To be competitive, I tried to make a better eye chart or bigger eye chart than my colleague. But this is simply to show up top is our president, over here is our provost, over here is our senior vice president for finance and administration, vice provost, vice presidents, and down at the bottom there are our deans. And so, I always find it interesting. This is published on the web. You know, it's almost cyclical. There's not a connection over here, but maybe there should be. The deans report up to the provost, but there's also a line of the deans skirting up and over here to the president. So we have challenged decision-making, I think, to say the least, at the university. Just to give a picture of our finances, we're about a $4.4 billion operation, and the lion's share is the School of Medicine and our clinical revenue, about 42% of our revenue. Aside from that, the next largest piece is APL, our Applied Physics Lab, which the university owns, and the other divisions of the university are spread throughout the remaining pieces of the pie. I have to mention the Johns Hopkins Health System. I know that we're university-centric, but because this is a large piece of our ERP, it's important to have a little bit of context. The Hopkins Health System now is comprised of three academic hospitals, including the Johns Hopkins Hospital, the U.S. News and World Report number one hospital in the country, 21 years running now, nearby Bayview Medical Center, and our latest acquisition is All Children's Hospital in St. Petersburg, Florida, which is our first one that's out of the greater Baltimore, Washington area. We also have three community hospitals, Howard County General, Sibley Memorial, which is in D.C., and Suburban Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland, and then some other parts of our health system include managed care plans with Johns Hopkins Healthcare, physician practices throughout the state and region in Johns Hopkins Community Physicians, and a full-service home care provider in Johns Hopkins Home Care Group. I mentioned earlier university and health system are two separate legal entities. We've created this non-legal entity called Johns Hopkins Medicine, where we combine together our School of Medicine from the university and the entirety of the health system. And we collectively manage those operations. So we have the dean of the School of Medicine is the CEO of Johns Hopkins Medicine. The president of the Johns Hopkins Health System is the executive vice president of Johns Hopkins Medicine. There's a separate CFO for Johns Hopkins Medicine than the CFO for the university, CFO for the health system. So it's a very it's a challenging environment. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But together, when we look at the university and the health system, it's about a $9.1 billion operation. our ERP architecture at Hopkins, the last decade we spent doing what I call near consolidation. Lots of legacy systems went away. We brought together divisional systems into central systems. That started with our student information system project. We call it ISIS, Integrated Student Information System. Probably half of you call yours the same. The product is SunGuard, a product called Matrix from SunGuard Higher Ed. Don't go looking for it. It doesn't exist anymore. SunGuard's announced their de-support of the product in 2006 while we were midstream of implementing, and they'll continue to support it through 2014, thankfully, and we'll live on a little beyond that. The product is an integrated system for admissions, financial aid, student billing, records, and registration. We had very phased go-lives starting in 2003 and then running through 2007. And then subsequently, other programs that were not in scope of our original implementation came on board to leverage the platform. And in that space, we're in the process of implementing a student warehouse based on iStrategy now Blackboard Analytics product. On the ERP side, we use SAP. We run financials, human resources, supply chain through that system. We use our SAP's business warehouses, our data warehouse, and our reporting platform. And different from our approach for the student systems, we did a big bang, and the entire university, entire health system went live, all three functions, January 1, 2007. I mentioned near consolidation. The reason that we didn't call it complete consolidation is there's always exceptions, probably no different from any of you in the room. You know, we do everything except. So our exceptions, we were successful in bringing financial aid into Matrix for all of the schools. That was already centralized in a mainframe-based system, so that was an easy win for us. Student billing, we do student billing in the Matrix system, except we don't do third-party sponsored billing in that system. And we don't do it in any system. It's kind of a manual process. Records and registration, we do all schools except the School of Medicine. They had a system they liked that kept with it. And frankly, that's caused us a great deal of consternation as we've been building our warehouses to try to get a full picture of the university. And then admissions, all of the schools except the School of Medicine were originally in scope and involved in our implementation, and then slowly they started to beg their way out of the implementation. On the SAP side, we did all of our billing except student billing, which is in ISIS, and we don't do patient billing in SAP. That's in the clinical systems. All of the university is in SAP except for the Applied Physics Lab, which is managed separately. And when we went live, all of the Johns Hopkins Health System except the Howard County General Hospital was brought into SAP. Now the other three hospitals have been added. They're not in SAP yet, but they will be someday. I stole Jason's slide. The reality is that our challenges are really no different than his challenges. We have the same issues with decision making, the local autonomy, the challenges of long memories of rocky implementations. So I won't give this any more treatment because our stories are very much the same.
So with the background context out of the way, we'll hit our case studies now. I'm going to talk about a couple of examples that applied to two projects that we've recently done. One was the implementation of Hyperion Planning as a budgeting system. The objective of that was to really replace Excel as the primary way that budgets were developed. We had a lot of challenges. There are multiple business process owners. When I showed that diagram of the academic structure, what I didn't mention was that each of those boxes also has a chief financial officer, a chief administrative officer. Each of them basically has an entire corporate structure within it in terms of decision-making and authority. So really, we were looking at this as implementing this same system for all of the different schools and being able to be responsive to their needs. There really were at least 20 different approaches to budgeting driven by the local requirements, and there were varying levels of end-user sophistication, so based on people who only budget when they're required to once a year versus those who very actively manage their cost centers. Some of the critical success factors for this project that make their way into the next few slides include a really reimagination of our central school engagement model, a high degree of transparency into decisions and priorities, and a focus on points of agreement. That project came to Harvard to be the project director for that implementation back in 2007. And we took a lot of the lessons learned from that project and applied them to another project that started soon thereafter, just to make sure that they were real lessons learned and not just lessons learned from one particular set of circumstances. And I think we were very successful in applying some of those same techniques related to engagement, governance, and really building buy-in at all levels in the hierarchy. That second project was an implementation of an e-procurement solution using Oracle iProcurement as part of the solution, as well as SciQuest for catalogs and punchouts. Some of the resistance we faced there were similar factors, of course, but also we had a big resistance to pre-commitment approval. We had uneven benefits across schools. Schools with high degree of scientific spend had a better value proposition than those that had professional services or other types of spending. And there was some confusion about project objectives. So what were we trying to achieve here? Did everybody have the same belief about what the goals were? So this is a diagram of what happened with the procurement project. And so we look at this and call it the hockey stick. And what happened was there was a pilot project that rolled out to a set of users initially with the expectation that it would really flow very naturally into a nice linear curve to the top. But instead what happened was we had several different issues with adoption, with change management, and we had the 2008-2009 fiscal crisis, so it was difficult to inject the type of skills we needed at that time to try to push through some of those challenges. So we took the project back up in early last year in 2010, and you can see this rapid ascension in terms of the number of users using what we call HCOM, which is Harvard Crimson Online Marketplace, and that refers to our procurement system. So at that point where we say deployment take two, that's where we implemented some of the things I'm going to talk about in the next couple slides. So we have this concept going back a really long time called the Local Implementation Manager, or the LIM. And this is a model that's been around since the late 90s when Oracle eBusiness Suite was implemented for financials. And the responsibilities of the LIM, recognizing the need for, in this decentralized environment, the need for a local key contact for the project within each of these organizations, the responsibilities of this individual were to provide local expertise or to make sure that they could coordinate the capture of the local business process expertise within the school to be the primary point of contact for their units and users as a conduit into the project, to manage a local tailored project plan for tasks that are required at the local level, to manage communications within the local unit, and to coordinate any particular design or testing for any customizations or other features that we implemented directly in response to a local specific need. So the LIM model, for all of the challenges I'm going to talk about in the next slide, has been a key success factor on all of our projects and is one of the only ways we have to have that point of contact at the local level. But when we think about what the model looks like or looked like, on the left we have these different organizations, most of which have one. You'll notice there's always a school that, because of its breadth, will have multiple of these LIMs, or because they contain units within the units. And then we have the central project team. So the problem is they had a single point of contact for us within their school, but we didn't have a really clear pathway for them to get into the project team. So you can think about if you've looked at communications networks, there's the mathematics of how many different potential lines of communication there are, and it's a very unwieldy thing. And similarly, different members of the project team would be responding to issues or looking for resolution would be potentially uncoordinated in their approach to the local implementation managers. So this resulted in a lack of clarity in terms of who to talk to. Sometimes where things were well coordinated, it was more accidental than thoughtful in terms of how that happened. And it also led often to perpetuation of an us versus them thought, that in the local unit it looked like Central was doing this to us, and often that was a problem of just the right messages not getting to the right people. And in general, this was a frustrating model. So when we started the budget project, we came up with this terrible name, and the DIM, it's a great title, Design and Implementation Manager. And I wish I had a good reason for how we came to that. It was just we kept thinking of titles, and none of them seemed quite right, or they were redundant with a title that meant something very specific. This meant nothing to anybody, so we started from a point of a clean slate about defining this function. And what we decided to do was to create these design implementation managers within the project team to be the face of the project out to each of the schools and units, and to serve also as an advocate within the project team for local needs. So their responsibility was to be a primary point of contact for a portfolio of schools or departments, often with similar characteristics, to help the LIMS define the local implementation strategies and plans, communications, et cetera, to work with them on helping them fit their local business process against the standard solution, the solution we were trying to put forth, to help coordinate training. And really, this is just a change, really putting a focus on the change management aspect of things. What I also liked about it when we were first putting this forward was saying, by embedding this person more tightly, these people more tightly with the organizations, they were able to represent the school's interests even within our project team meeting. Without having school representatives present, we had their opinions represented, and that was very, very helpful for us in trying to design solutions. So what this looked like is, on the left, we have the same model. We have the schools, we ask them to set up their LIMS, but a project team looks a lot different. By putting these DIMs, sort of portfolio manager type personnel, you know, pulling them a little bit away from the project, this vastly simplified the communications between the local implementation managers and the actual project team. And in the same way, that person could then deal with the multiple points of contact with technical, functional, training, and project management, other resources within the team. So although some of the complexity within the team isn't going to go away, from a school perspective, this is a much simpler point of engagement. So I think what this resulted in was more really one-on-one attention to local needs. The DIMs went and met with schools individually, met with the CFOs, controllers, financial managers at those organizations, and really was listening to their needs and making sure that they were brought back and put into the issue management system. We had a much deeper knowledge of school requirements. We had enhanced customer service. We had better performance against estimates. We've had no slippage, really, in these projects. Considering that really we looked at them each as sort of a whole lot of projects under an umbrella, that's been, I think, a real success factor. In terms of governance, this was a recent article from the Harvard Business Review, and I liked this quote regarding, you know, one of the problems with governance is this whole idea about what's actually happening in there, and the lack of transparency in decision making can lead to people being frustrated. So, you know, in our environment, the governance process previously, there was a degree to which schools felt that they were excluded from the decision-making process. And due to the huge number of stakeholders, it was hard. We would want to represent their needs, but it's hard to have a meeting with 70 people, a decision-making meeting. And so it was really important that we were trying to move from a place where some of these projects were viewed as driven out of IT or out of central admin, and more to where it was a collaboration to actually address business needs through a shared application environment. So what we tried to do, we've done with all, not only these two projects, but other projects that are in play, is have a single vision for what a governance should look like, and making sure that there's a place in here for local end users, for middle management, for local executives, and for university executives. And so we have this common structure in terms of outreach to identify opportunities with end users, subject matter experts, and a lot of networking with peers. Requirements coming through, a collection of the local implementation managers getting in a room together and sharing, and then trying to take those opportunities and convert them into requirements. Escalating that up through a steering committee, which is, again, next level local senior leadership, and then on up to an executive committee. And so we've standardized this on all of our projects, which has been nice. And I'm running short on time, so I'm going to go through these. So one of the things we also tried to do was really make sure we had broad representation across the different groups. Because we had a multiple committee structure, although that looks unwieldy, it meant that we could give a voice to many different organizations. They might not be represented on every committee, but they were represented on a committee. We also tried to look at affinities to say that we have a small school voice, a medium school voice, and a large school voice in each of the committees, so that at least we could take advantage of some affinities between organizations. We used a lot of transparent decision-making, voting systems. We monetized our development capacity and the cost of potential enhancements and tried to use sort of a bartering system that was really run by the schools who were in these groups. I think it was important for us to engage stakeholders. We went through a vendor selection process for the budgeting project, and they were involved all the way. So we invited them. Obviously, it was an option for them to say, I don't have time for that. But we said, well, you're allowed to come. Even if you can't come to the meetings, here are the responses from our vendors. Please give us your opinion. That'll be factored into our decision-making process. And then we've made all of the final results of how we made our decision public to that group. And so our principle here was, if you agree with the process, you can't really just challenge the outcome. So we tried to spend a lot of time really building that. Of course, there's an asterisk there that, in theory, in reality, are two different things. We also, in terms of messaging, sometimes had a problem where, if I think about the and I'll zip through this, the procurement project, one of the reasons for that spike or for the long trough was really that different people had different perspectives about what the point was of the project. And also we had invested most of our time talking at the grassroots level, which made end users who were using the application very happy, but the message wasn't bubbling up. We needed to be addressing it both at all levels. We needed to be talking to the grassroots, especially if there was a real tangible benefit for the users, to get them excited about it. We needed to talk to the executives to make sure that we had strategic support for this. And then we also really did have to focus on the middle management. That's the membrane between the end users and the executives. And so we really spent a lot of time thinking about how to realign the message and deliver that. And so one of the things we did on the Procure to Pay project was to really go back and say, we need executive roadshows, meeting with school CFOs, and saying, this is what we're trying to do, and customizing our story to meet what we'd expect them to see for real benefits. So school X, this is what you're going to see, and being very candid to say, you're not going to get as much benefit as school Y, but we still think this is really important and valuable, and here's how and why we're going to do this with you. Not to you or for you, but with you. We also really took advantage, I think, of these techniques from other projects. And then the last thing was memorializing success, I think, is kind of key. This is a picture from the hallway outside my office that as we rolled out each organization, the procurement system, we printed the first PO that was generated and taped it on the wall. And so every day I could come in. I didn't have to ask where we were. I could just look and see that 5 new POs had shown up on the wall, and that was a really great way to kind of show success. I didn't go into some details about what these projects looked like within the projects, what they delivered. There are some links here to some presentations we've done at Open World, OAUG, and the Higher Ed User Group Alliance Conference, if anybody is interested in any of those things.
Excuse me. So to talk a little bit about what we've done at Hopkins, the two projects I mentioned, the SAP implementation and ISIS, they're interesting from the direction in which the project came. The SAP project, this was a top-down mandate, top-down mandate in a decentralized place like Hopkins doesn't go very well. So this was it had its own particular challenges because of that. In contrast, our ISIS implementation for the student systems was a grassroots effort. It actually came out of some of our divisions saying what we've got centrally or what we have today simply doesn't meet our needs. We need more. We need different. And they championed the project and ultimately got support from the president and provost office. So they were very different models. And they also, our decision making was at very different ends of the spectrum for both of these. In the ISIS system and the matrix product that we implemented, we allow a significant amount of divisional latitude, a lot that you can do within each division, within your financial aid implementation, and different from the next school down the road or across the campus. On the SAP side, however, we had very little latitude for the divisions within the university. So there was a single design, and that's what got implemented, generally speaking. The reason that we don't go all the way to the right to be completely centralized to that extent is, there's always those exceptions. And our School of Medicine implemented the financial system differently than did all of the other schools of the university. And interestingly, differently than the health system did. So we have interesting challenges, I think, but we spread the spectrum in these two projects alone. To talk a little bit more about our student information system, I mentioned it's ISIS. This was the first university-wide fully integrated student information system. So its legacy, the legacy systems that it replaced, there were some mainframe-based systems that were commonly shared by the schools, but they were loosely integrated, not tightly coupled. And then there were some other divisional systems that were managed completely by the schools and not centrally.
When we looked, so about a decade ago, we looked for product. Matrix was determined to be the ideal solution for Johns Hopkins because it allows the autonomy that we have and we embrace and we enjoy. It allows us to have a single centralized person concept. In fact, there's another module of the system called Common that is where the person data is stored, and then the person data is shared out with financial aid, billing, and registration, so on. And these concepts of zones and data domains allow us to segregate down to schools, divisions, programs, and so on. When we bought the product, it was in development by Sallie Mae Solutions, then Exeter bought it, then SCT bought it, then SunGard bought SCT, now Datatel. So it's had a long history, and it really never gained a lot of momentum for a number of reasons. We were a development partner along with our colleagues from the University of Chicago, University of Arizona. Two of the three of us are still standing on the system today. But the advantage of that fact is that we are able to support ourselves when the vendor discontinues their support in just a couple years. So in the ISIS implementation I mentioned earlier, we started in March 2003 was our first go-live, and go-lives happened then on until 2007. As you can see here, these are the modules of the system I mentioned, and then these are programs or divisions of the university. And we did 30 separate implementations of the system. We brought up the common personal person information generally for most schools. In 2003 to support other implementations. We had a dizzying array of admissions implementations and re-implementations in one case. We did have a common billing implementation. That was a big win for us. And financial aid was kind of scattered somewhere between the two. And because the product allows you to be very distinct and still be in the same system, it enabled us to do this. But I'm sure you can imagine, you know, the number of stakeholders involved in an implementation like this. And aside from the functional stakeholders whose business is being uprooted by this, add in then nine chief financial officers who are deciding how your money's being spent is a challenge. Some of the lessons learned as I speak of our beloved CFOs, we had to rethink our governance midstream. We were having some challenges in terms of decision making in our project. One reason was we had a finance committee and we had an executive committee, and our finance committee were the CFOs and the executive committee were folks responsible for enrollment management in each of the schools. And we had this pattern where we would have the financial committee meet, and then an hour later the executive committee would meet and the finance people would say, we're not doing that, and we'd have to tell the executive committee we're not doing that. We decided that was not very efficient, so we squashed it into a two-hour meeting and we had people sitting across the table from each other so they could tell each other what we're doing or not doing. And then we actually got to much better and crisper decision-making for that project. We implemented just enough data governance. Data governance is one of the largest challenges that we have at Hopkins, both on both sides of the university and the health system. We did enough that we can implement a common system, and that common module was kind of the basis for that, and enough so that the pieces could work together, but not enough that we had common definitions of lots of things. And that now is causing us indigestion, I think, if nothing else, heartache, heartburn, in our student data warehouse implementation, because now, even though, generally speaking, all of our student data is in this one system, it is managed in 30 different ways in this one system. We effectively have to transform it all those different ways to get into our warehouse that we're building now. One of the big things that was a key to the success of this implementation was our support model, where we built both our implementation model and our support model really replicated the decentralized nature of the school. We had people, similar to the LIM model that Jason mentioned, we had people embedded in each of the divisions. They were divisional staff, not central IT staff, and their job was to do the implementation, to do the configuration of the system, to write rules, to write reports. And those people also now are the first line of defense. If you're in a billing office and you have a problem with the system, you call your local resource first, and then they talk to us. But we manage the system overall. We manage change management, change control processes, and did the entire project management for the project. And I think in any, probably true, whether you're centralized or decentralized, transparency is exceedingly important, particularly in our case. And so we needed to find ways to make sure that everyone knew what was happening. And with so many varied stakeholders, that was critically important to do that. And we used a number of technologies that enabled us to do that. Now where we are, we're at an interesting point to
to jump to the bottom, would we do this again? And it's an open question. I don't have an answer for us right now. But we're starting to watch ISIS disintegrate. A lot of that is because of the vendor's decision that they're not going to support the product for the future. So we're looking for a financial aid system that we're going to plug in. We're looking at power fades right now. But slowly, I think we're going to see pieces fall away. And ISIS will still be around as a hub for us, and we move from an integrated system to an integrated platform of systems. And I think that the foundation is in place to have good conversations about the sorts of things that we need to do to enable the move to platform thinking instead of sticking with a single integrated system for the future. The other side was our SAP system. This was called Hopkins One, the old idea of having one Hopkins together in one system. Typical reasons for implementing an ERP, they were true for us. We've got antiquated, expensive systems to maintain. Nice opportunity for business process redesign if you take it. Greater integration of services between the university and the health system, and there's a lot of that happening because of our Johns Hopkins Medicine group, and again, the ability to support that, the ability to go into a common financial system, pull data out for both entities and report how Johns Hopkins Medicine is doing. Anticipated benefits of this, again, not indifferent from many ERP implementations here or elsewhere. Integrating business processes into a single system, reducing duplication of efforts, and reducing errors, and optimizing our work. This depicts the scope of our implementation. Again, our supply chain, finance, and HR were our focuses. We do our pre-award. We implemented COEUS as part of the SAP implementation because SAP didn't have a pre-award option. We do post-award financial management and grants management in SAP. We implemented the data warehouse. Also here, that probably not too common in the university setting, is warehouse management. We have a large warehouse that manages our inventories for the two hospitals in Baltimore, and that's become a critical function in terms of efficiencies and of operations that we realized through the implementation. So there was kind of that holy trinity of reasons to do this, improving service for our faculty, for our divisions, for all of our entities, improving decision-making. Improving productivity with a system that has more integration, it has better collections processes and billing processes and contract management and so on. And, of course, compliance in one system where you can see everything you need to see. So I sat with my team on Monday, in fact, and said, I know a lot of our lessons learned. I was fortunate, I think, maybe to not have been in the implementation years ago. I just inherited it a couple years back. So I asked those who had the battle scars, I said, if you could do it over, what would you do differently? And in 10 minutes, we filled a whiteboard. And I promised I wouldn't tell them exactly what they said, but I wanted to give you a sense of what it was that we were able to do in just 10 minutes. There were a lot of lessons learned. I think it's hard to depict best practices for us because I don't know that we're a poster child for best practices for this type of an implementation. And frankly, there aren't a lot of people who do implementations like us, bringing two corporations into one system and managing them separately under one cover was a challenge. And we talk a lot with health systems that are trying to do this or universities that are trying to do this, but never the two together. So we remain very unique. And our challenges, I think, are unique in some of those regards. Some of the bigger lessons learned about SAP. SAP is a fantastic product, and I can't endorse it formally, but it really is a phenomenal product. The challenge, I think, with SAP, and they say the best-run businesses run SAP. That's their tagline. I think the issue is that if you buy SAP, you buy it for best practices, and then you implement SAP following their best practices, and then you have best practices. You don't buy SAP and implement your same old crappy practices and processes in SAP. It's very hard to do that. I think we did that a little too much, both on the university side and the health system side. So thinking a little bit about the alignment of the vendor. And some of that is the vanilla. How vanilla do you stay with what the vendor provides you? But the rest of it is, in the case of SAP, they really have regimented ways to do things. And if you follow them, you can realize the savings that they talk about. You really need to follow them to get there. The other is SAP has a lot of success in the production, manufacturing, a lot of industries outside of public sector. So it was a kind of a contrived fit in a way for organizations like us where we don't have widgets, we have people, we have patients, we have students, we have faculty. And so it was it fits, but it's a little more challenging. It isn't their bread and butter, so that became some challenges for us. Underestimating change management, I think, is perhaps the biggest lesson learned. This was huge, huge, huge change for everybody in the organization. And making sure people are ready. I think no matter what you can do, you can never do it enough. You can never reach out to enough people, get them ready for what's happening. It's always greater than expected. And especially when you go from disintegrated systems to integrated systems, to have people who have an appreciation for the fact that if I do something here, someone down here might be affected by what I do. Don't have to know everything that happens, but just realize that there are those sorts of issues. Transparency is tricky, especially with two different organizations and lots of different stakeholders, and you've got the faculty, and you've got administrators, and you've got end users, you get a lot of feedback from a lot of different people in trying to figure out what you need to listen to, what you don't need to listen to, and how you ensure that the voices are heard. You kind of close that feedback loop is a big issue for us. You do only have one chance to make a first impression, and particularly with a project that has a lot of PR around it. And that goes to change management, I think, too, you know, in terms of getting people ready, prepared, and off and running. This is one that we can't underscore enough, is really thinking about security, because there's a lot around how people are going to access data and what they're able to do with the data and how they get to the data that you really have to be prepared for. And decisions you make early, you live with for a very, very long time. And we're suffering from that a little bit right now. I mentioned earlier this was top down, not bottom up, so this was not natural for the university, and so it challenged us, I think, to our core to have faculty being told this is what's going to happen. And ultimately we had the support of the faculty in doing this, but it was not easy. This is something I think Jason touched on a little bit too, the balance between the top 20 and 80%. So you can look at the people who do the most transactions or the people who do the most purchasings, have the largest dollar spend, things of that sort, and they'll send you in one direction, and then there's the other 80% of the group. And trying to figure out who we need to listen to the most in each of the different areas, I think, is a particular challenge and one that we've learned lots of lessons from. So this kind of just depicts a lot of the themes that Jason and I talked about today. Transparency, collaboration, need for change management, the stakeholder engagement, cultures, decision making. These are all from in decentralized institutions like ours. These are they're common threads, I think, clearly. So we're just about out of time, but we'll be happy to take any questions from the group. Sure. So the ISIS system is one actual physical system. What we're starting to think of now is ISIS as a platform. The ISIS system is the hub of that platform, but we're starting to peel functions out of that system. So as I mentioned, financial aid, we're looking at implementing power fades. We're going to we'll shut down the financial aid function in ISIS, use power fades, integrate the two tightly together, and what we then call the power fades ISIS combination is this integrated student platform as opposed to just an integrated system or system of systems, as the case may be. In terms of who's handling it from? Yes. Yeah, we're in the process right now of planning that project, but we're looking at a model that was very similar to what we did for ISIS.
A question from Harvard. Was there resistance to the shift from the then direct access to the
funding to the DIM intermediary? No, actually, my feeling is that it was a relief to know I go to this one person. I think it depended on the fact if they weren't getting good customer service from that point of contact, it would have been a different conversation. And in a couple of cases, we had to switch. We had an assignment where the LIM and the DIM, since that has to be a really good relationship, we had a couple of personality conflicts and had to change the assignments.
But generally, I think it was viewed as this is an easier way for me to be able to get my needs represented within the project. But it was really dependent on seeing outcomes that were consistent with what we had promised. Well, we're really just starting to reimagine what business intelligence will look like. We're not a particularly analytics-driven organization, so we have a lot of operational reporting that comes out of the data warehouse and a heavy reliance on ad hoc reporting using interactive reporting or Brio. And so we're just at the start of that, to be candid. That's the next horizon. Now, once we get through this big bubble of upgrades that we're doing, that's kind of the next thing ahead. So.
And we're in the same place, frankly, just really starting to get momentum in the space of BI and analytics.
Using the SAP tools?
We are using a number of different tools, but we've just acquired Business Objects, which is an SAP company now, and we're trying to use that as our standard platform, but I'm sure there will be plenty of standard platforms. I wouldn't because we did a centralized system from the bottom up in the student system space. In our case, for having to combine two companies, there was no way to do that otherwise, I think. But if I were to think of the university, if the university were alone implementing an ERP, I think it could have been successful with a bottom up, with the school saying we need better financial management or we need better processes for procurement or ability to manage our human capital. I think that could have happened, I think that demand was there, but it wasn't coming that way. The students that transcend divisions, the faculty that teach in multiple divisions, we have a fair amount of that. So we do try to do that to some extent. So we are out of time. So thank you for joining us. Appreciate it if you would thank you. If you take some time to fill out the evaluation, if you'd like to tweet us, give us some feedback, answer any other questions that we didn't have a chance to today.